So let's ask Don to deliver the last lecture, in which he has something very interesting to say about Carlos Theory. I hope you'll be not a war. We'll have donuts and coffee at the end. So
we can throw them at each other then? All right, thank you. The first lecture I gave, I started off, and a couple of people immediately said Arrow's theorem, or Sense theorem, or the Condorcet triplet, and various things like that. And I said, I think I'm going to change my last lecture. So I show them what is Arrow's theorem, etc. You see, probably in the social sciences, these three titles right here, smash, bang, Arrow's theorem, Sense theorem, Condorcet triplet, probably are the best known type results. People in the social sciences know it, people in mathematicians do not. And so I'm going to introduce all of it, show how they're all connected and all related. And what I plan to do, and everything I state is in my book from Cambridge University Press, Decisions and Elections, came out last October. I'm going to try to show that a lot of these ideas, that first of all, Arrow's theorem, Sense theorem, etc., do not mean what we've been told they meant for the last half century. They have a very different interpretation. And what I'm going to show is that once, or try to indicate, is that once you understand what Arrow's theorem and Sense theorem really mean, their significance becomes greater. Because you then see where they fit in to a large number of other issues in the social sciences. Actually, probability, statistics, manufacturing, engineering, and on and on. But before we do that, do I have a game for you? I have a chance for you to become rich. We have a little game. I've got three dice. You choose one of them. Give you first choice. You can chew it, you can look at it, and roll. I'll choose another, and we'll play the game. After we played the game for a while, if you want to change, take my die, go ahead. I'll give you my die, I'll choose another one. And I'll clean you out. Okay. What we're going to do is my dice. Well, a dice each die is fair. It's got six sides. And on two of the sides, I'm going to have an eight. Two of them I'm going to have a 1, and two of them I'm going to have a 6. And so what we have is die 1, die 2, and die 3, and there's the listings of the numbers. Perfect square. You all see this immediately. It's a perfect square. What I'm going to do is, since when I take any two die, the reason I know this, if I take any two die, what do I have? I've got 9 pairs, and each pair is equally likely to occur. You can't divide 9 in half with an integer. You're going to get 4.5. So one die has to be better than the other. So they're not fair dice. And take a look. Indeed, die 1, this will beat all 3 of these, so it wins 3 pairs. 6 wins 2 of them, so it's going to win 5 of the pairs, and die 2 will win 4 of the pairs. All right? Likewise, die 2 is better than die 3. That's because 3 will beat 2, 5 will beat 2, and 4, 7 will beat you. So this will have 5 to 4. So which die do you want? Die 1, of course. Except that die 3 is better than die 1. Because 4 beats 1, 2 beats 1, and 9 beats all 3 of them. And so what we really have then is intransitivity. That die 1 beats die 4, 2, die 2 beats die 3 beats die 1, all by that amount. Or if you want a different set of dies, do them this way. Die 1, die 2, die 3 along this edge right here. The point of this example is to show that simple aggregation can lead to cycles. Here's a very simple problem that we end up with, a simple probability problem. And if you go back to your textbooks and about independent events and independent random variables, etc., really one of the things they're trying to exclude by the conditions are cycles of this type right here. The point is that they, if they occur in probability, they most surely crop up in voting. And they do. If I have three people with the preferences A, B, C, three with the preferences, you can read them right across there. Maybe you can't, because I'm in your way. Let's take a look at an A-B election. A will get 3-6 votes. B will get the rest, 6-4. So A is better than B. I look at B-C. B will get 3-6 votes, and C will get the other 4. Or maybe 5, I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. B beat C, that's the important thing. And now we look at AC, and we have that C beats A. C beats A, gets at least 6 votes, and we'll say it gets 4, might be less. But the point is that A beats B, B beats C, and C beats A, with a simple pairwise voting. Kenneth Arrow was inspired by examples of this type right here, in pairwise voting. And what he did is he said, look, see, Kenneth Arrow got his PhD from Harvard in the Applied Math Department in statistics. And what he did is he said, look, why don't I try to find a perfect voting procedure? So what he's going to do is look at it from the mathematics approach. Let's write down some axioms of what we want our voting procedure to satisfy. And then let's find all possible procedures which satisfy those conditions. So what did he do? Is he said, what about our inputs? I'm going to write it in terms of a mathematics, in terms of a mapping from a domain into a range and the function. So we need to know our domain. And a domain is just simply going to be the strict transitive preferences of the voters. It's strict. And I don't want ties. In other words, if a voter prefers A to B and B to C, then that same voter prefers A to C. So the two conditions on the input is that there are strict transitive preferences of the voters. That's what it consists of. And there are no restrictions on how the rankings are ranked. Output. What we don't want to have a societal outcome, which is a cycle. If we have a cyclic outcome, we'll say that, well, doing this is better than that, doing that's better than that, but doing, it sounds like politics anyway. But going around and around in a circle. And so the output is that we want a transitive societal ranking. So far, everything is pretty obvious. This is what you obviously want for your inputs. That's what you obviously want for your output. Now all the things left is to specify conditions on the procedure. And we're going to be very, very minimal. We're going to say that if we have candidates, and if there is a particular pair, if everybody, unanimity, everybody prefers A to B, then boy, that better be the societal ranking. So pairwise unanimity is that if everyone prefers A to B or B to A, whichever, whatever the ranking is, then the societal ranking is A to B, that the societal ranking will respect unanimity over pairs. The next condition is, why just unanimity? For example, you've all had departmental meetings or anything else. Or let's not get into thorny issues. Let's talk in terms of maybe we're having a listing of the outstanding mathematicians of this century, the last century. Poincaré, Birkhoff, and Smith. Never heard of Smith? Either have I. And suppose the ranking is that we discover that Poincaré is listed above Birkhoff, above Smith. But the prize committee comes out and says, yes, but Birkhoff would have been better if more people liked Smith. What does Smith have to do with the ranking of Birkhoff and Poincaré? And so binary relevance or independence of irrelevant alternatives, just simply says that the pairwise ranking is based on voters' ranking of pair. In other words, when we're talking about who dominates, Birkhoff or Poincaré, it really doesn't matter what people think of Smith, because Smith is irrelevant for that comparison, so the societal ranking should be here. Okay, I guess I could go on and give other conditions, but let's stop here and see what we have. At this stage, we want to compute and determine all possible mappings, all possible procedures, which satisfy, this is obvious, that's obvious, this is minimal. And the result is, there's only one procedure. A dictatorship. The only possible procedure is a dictatorship. And it's not... And it is not a benevolent dictatorship, because what it is a dictatorship that if I'm the dictator, designated the dictator, it means that whatever I want, that's what the societal ranking is going to be. The hell are the rest of you. No matter if you want, if you're absolutely against me or not, it doesn't matter. This theorem, it's impossible to overstate the importance of this theorem, what it had. People are driving up until this time, were busy trying to find equitable type procedures, etc. And Arrow wrote this as his PhD thesis. And it had and it played a major role in his Nobel Prize of 1972. It has, to this day, caused incredible amount of difficulties. It is a barrier, a severe barrier in trying to do research in a lot of these areas. How can you? Nothing's fair, is what they say. Any questions about what the theorem says? I'm going to explain a different interpretation in a little while. Not long after that, Sen, who got the... And his result played a role in his Nobel Prize, although not as prominent, had a different theorem. And the theorem really goes on the following. You know, I kind of like that shirt you got on, by the way. Really
you
nice.
Can't have it.
Yeah, but who said you could wear it?
I did. I'm the chair.
You did. You were allowed to wear that.
Benevolent dictator.
Yeah, but you know what the usual answer I get for that?
No.
My wife. Okay. So what we have here is that there are certain decisions within our own sphere of influence, that he should be allowed to decide the societal ranking, that he's going to wear this shirt rather than a red one that he had this morning. That there is none of our business. And the idea of liberalism and minimal liberalism, it's that there are certain things that we, individuals, should be able to determine. Heck with everyone else. Is this possible? So in about 1975... almost a quarter of a century after Kenneth Arrow, Sen started seeing, is it possible? So he says, for inputs, strict rankings, same inputs, obvious inputs, strict rankings, and no restrictions. But for outputs, he says, not transitive rankings, but no cycles. Now, this generalizes Arrow's theorem in the following sense, is that we are allowed to have situations where A and B are tied, B and C are tied, but A beats C. You're about the same height. You're about the same height, but he's taller than you. Okay, so you end up with situations of that type. And so he wants to have no cycles, which is a much more general type situation. Procedure. For procedure, he says that he wants pairwise unanimity. And then the next condition is where he was allowed to choose his shirt this morning. It says that there are certain, at least two people, he's one of them, and they're given a pair of alternatives. And you can decide over that pair, and what anyone else thinks, the heck with them. And you're the other decisive agent. You've got your pair, and you can decide, and what anyone else says, the heck with them. Okay? Very, very minimal. Minimal liberalism. And the conclusion, for three or more alternatives, no procedure exists. So what we have then is arrows and sense theorem have caused all kinds of problems. Arrows says, forget it when you're trying to do all of these types of decision problems. You're going to have unfairness. And sense theorem says, even when we're talking in terms of people having certain rights, ain't going to happen. The literature is incredibly huge and keeps growing about both of them. Let me give you a proof by example, of one example of sense theorem. So I have four alternatives, A, B, C, and D. All right? And voter one is decisive over A, B. So I got dashes here saying what the other people believe is immaterial. Voter two is decisive over C, D. So I have dashes there. What they have is immaterial. And voter one has the preferences D, A, B, C. Voter two and everyone else, all 10,000 other people, have the preferences B, C, D, A. So let's write down the rankings. This person right here, it's clear, prefers A to B. Everybody, if you check, prefers B to C. This person right here prefers C to D. And if you check, everyone prefers D to A. Oops. So, by minimal liberalism, this person prefers A, B. That's the societal ranking. That's your shirt. By unanimity, everyone prefers C, B, C. C, D, by minimal liberalism. And by unanimity, D, A. You get a cycle. All kinds of articles in philosophy journals and everything else explaining this and trying to say, well, maybe we should do this and maybe we should do that, etc. I'm not a philosopher, I'm a mathematician. So as a mathematician, what is it that I want to do is I want to go back and look at each of the axioms and say, who caused the problems? Where did the problems crop up? So let's see. Let's take a look at the conditions and see where it caused the problems. The inputs look pretty good. The outputs look pretty good. Well, wait a minute. Maybe the transitive preferences of the voter. Let's start right at the top. Does that play any role, the fact that the voters are transitive? Let's check. So, you know, very unimaginative mathematician. You start at the top and you work down and you just twiddle the axioms and conditions and see what happens. So let's twiddle that. Let's suppose that rather than having transitive preferences, that everyone has the preferences D, A, B. They prefer D to A, they prefer A to B, they prefer B to C, and they prefer C to D, and so they have cyclic preferences. Let's throw away transitivity and assume that everybody is cyclic. And see what differences we get. So when we fill out this table, everybody prefers A to B. Everybody prefers B to C. Everybody prefers C to D. And everyone prefers D to A. Notice anything? They're both identically the same. In other words, the assumption that voters have transitive preferences plays zero role in sense theorem. We think it plays an important role. It is just a nice condition. But it plays zero role in there. And what I'm going to show you is that, or I'm going to indicate to you, is that minimal liberalism has the effect of annihilating that assumption. minimal liberalism has the effect of taking that and making it non-effective, just dropping it out. Let's see. Suppose I have A is better. Suppose when we're talking in terms of wines, I prefer red wine to white wine, and white wine to, help me.
Beer.
White wine to beer. Do I prefer red wine to beer? Do I have transitive preferences? Can't tell. You can't tell. You don't have enough information. That really what happens is transitivity. You can impose transitivity, but are we using that information, or are we throwing away information? If I prefer A to B and B to C, that implies that I prefer A to C. But to be able to determine whether I'm transitive, I need to have all of this information. And what is it that we have in this example? To find whether the person has transitive preferences or not, I really need, in this example, I really need for the first person to know what she thinks about C and D. Without knowing that, I don't know if that person is transitive or not transitive. And for that reason, I can impose a cyclic voter and transitive voters, and you get exactly the same because you can't tell them apart. I'm going to a little bit hint for the mathematicians where symmetry groups comes in here, where the argument is due to symmetry groups. In fact, let me prove that this is, that what happens is that this is the source of all possible sen examples. All possible examples that you can that illustrate sense examples is exactly what I just wrote on the board up here. That you're losing the information whether the voters have transitive preferences or cyclic preferences. And that is the real source, it's the lost information. So what am I going to do? Is I'm going to create an example where A is better than B, is better than C, is better than A. And where A is better than B, is better than D, is better than E, is better than A. This is an example of the type you don't find in the literature. It's too hard to construct in a normal fashion. But I'm going to show you how easy it is to construct. What does minimal liberalism do? Minimal liberalism has to take information, whether a person has cyclic or transitive preferences, and throw it away. So, somewhere in here, for each person, I have to throw away one of these three links. So we can't distinguish whether they're cyclic, have cyclic preferences, or transitive preferences. So let's do that. Let's say that voter 1 is what? Is decisive over AB. If I say voter 1 is decisive over AB, then I don't use this information at all. The voter can have AB or BA. Okay? And if you change it to BA, you're going to find that we're going to get transitive preferences here. Indeed, if I break this link here, I break the link for this cycle and for this cycle right here, and you could read off the preferences. B, C, A, D, E, C, A. You can read off transitive preferences right away just by throwing away that one link. Now I have to get transitive preferences for voter 1, so I've got to break a link up here and break a link here. So let's say voter 2 is, I don't know, transitive over, is decisive over CA. So we can reverse those two. And let's suppose voter 3, so that breaks this link for voter 1, and now I've got to break a link in this cycle, so let's say DE. So we'll say voter 3 is decisive over here. And by doing that, by breaking the links which give me one link in each cycle, I can write down transitive preferences for the voters. The important point from the perspective of decision analysis, etc., is that all possible examples
using sense theorem are constructed in this way.
In other words, the theorem thinks it's dealing with cyclic voters, and so therefore you have unanimity, so it's giving that down. It's throwing away the information. It doesn't know that. So sense, you can create any number of examples you want now. I got this cycle here. Throw in a cycle here. Whatever cycle you want. You see how to do it. You just have to break one of these links and things like this. And you create an example, and away you go. So the source of sense theorem is not a conflict between society and individuals, as we see in almost all descriptions of it. It is that information is lost. And what is the information? The lost information is transitive preferences. So we lose the information that the voters have transitive preferences. It is my contention that all of the major impossibility results, which we have in economics and political science and the social sciences, and I'm going to even show you for engineering, are based on exactly this reason right here. Let's go back to prove this with Arrow's theorem. Here's Arrow's theorem. And what does it say? And everybody nodded their heads when I said it. Binary independence. We said that the ranking between A and B should only depend on what the people believe in terms of A and B. Now, if I tell you that I prefer A to B over A, B, and C, do I have transitive preferences or not? You have no way of knowing. No way of knowing. And so what Arrow's theorem really says is the following. It's that if you're throwing away from the inputs, we're assuming in the inputs that the preferences are transitive, but if we're throwing away the information that people have transitive preferences, we're not using it, then what happens is, what can the procedure do? Only in lucky situations can it give you a transitive outcome. And what's a lucky situation? One voter. If I have transitive preferences, then and we only look at my one voter, then we put it together. That's where the dictatorship comes from. It has nothing to do with dictatorships. It has nothing to do with unfairness. It has to do that if you want to use Arrow's theorem, you are throwing away incredible amount of information, the information that the voters have transitive preferences. Let me illustrate that. Let's look at the pairwise vote in the Condorcet triplet. A, B, C. So what happens is I have the ranking A is in first place, B is in second place, C is in third place. Now I'm going to rotate this 120 degrees. So I have 1, 2, 3. B is in second place, first place, C is in second place, A is in third place. Rotate it again 120 degrees. And I will get the ranking CAB. This is nothing more than mathematicians call it a Z3 orbit. People in social sciences call it a Condorcet triplet. What I've done now is I've listed the pairs for each ranking. First of all, the ranking should be a tie, as I've argued before. The ranking should be a tie. Come on. Everybody's in first place once, second place once, third place once. There's nobody has a favoritism over anyone else. So the ranking should be a tie. But in pairwise ranking, for mathematicians, Z3 does not have a subgroup of order 2. But when we take a look at the vote in pairwise rankings, A beats B 2 times, B beats A once, B beats C two times, once. Two times, once. So the outcome is a cycle. And it is due to this various symmetries. It's caused by this circular symmetries. So what we have then is, let me show you where the irrational voter comes in, the lost information. The lost information comes in, does the pairwise vote know who's voting what way? Does the pairwise vote know whether this is the first voter's preferences? Or this gives you the first voter's preferences? It cannot distinguish between the transitive preferences and where the first voter has cyclic preferences. And where the second voter has cyclic preferences. So I have two people with these cyclic preferences and one with these preferences. So in other words, the pairwise vote, it turns out that if I look at these parts and reassemble them in different ways, turns out I can get five different profiles. One is transitive, four are cyclic. And the four cyclic ones do what? They give you the cycle as the natural outcome. You can prove Arrow's theorem by looking at the parts. In fact, this is how I really did it, is by saying that if I'm looking at parts, then really the natural symmetry group is what happens when I flip each part. And so inside that orbit, I have to get cyclic voters. So really what happens is you can reprove Arrow's theorem and showing that that it is really trying to balance cyclic voters, the non-existent cyclic voters, versus transitive voters. So all Arrow's theorem does is it throws out the information that the voters have cyclic preferences. Notice how I did that? Coming down like this. In other words, the method which I used was going down here and going down here and going down here. You know, if I took this edge, glued it together, and took these two edges and glued them together, I'd get lines on a torus, which gives you the symmetry. It gives you the right symmetry. And now let's look at that perfect square. And I'm going to have shadow lines over here. I put a 1, I put a 2 here, oops, not here, so I go down here. 3 here, whoops, not here, so I go over here. 4, 5, 6, 7, then whoops, better go down. 7, 8, 9, there's my perfect square. Still a kind of a slanting of this kind. And really it turns out that large number of these examples where you get cyclic outcomes uses symmetries which are not unfamiliar to people who are looking on flows on tori and various things like this. Not unfamiliar at all. So what is the lost information? The lost information about Arrow's theorem, Senn's theorem, and a large number of others is that voters are transitive. Really what happens is some of the assumptions just immediately throws that out. So rather than Arrow's theorem saying no method is fair, it just says, if you want to have this assumption, you're throwing away valuable information. You're throwing away valuable information about the voters, about the domain. And why would you want to do that? Same thing carries over to statistics. Same thing carries over to probability. It turns out that the pairwise ranking problems that we have in statistics, the pairwise ranking problems we have in probability, are all due to cyclic information like this. Totally due to cyclic information of this type. ZN information. Other consequences? Well, I'll come back to that if I have time. Okay. Now, the next question is, if that's the source of all the problems with Arrow's theorem and with Senn's theorem, And here's where I state mathematically what's really going on. It's that we think we're dealing only with transitive preferences, the symmetries, and the problem itself says we're dealing with things that aren't there, that we don't know are there. So how do we repair Arrow's theorem? Well, there's the troublemaker. There's the troublemaker. That's the result. That's the condition right here. That binary independence. This is the condition which throws away all the information. It says it says that I really don't have, can't tell if I'm dealing with cyclic voters or transitive voters. And so the condition then is that if you throw binary independence plus, what's plus? Write down just about any plus you want. That checks and uses information that voters are transitive. Just about anything which checks and uses information that voters are transitive. You no longer have a dictator. You get a whole slew of procedures. Of very usable procedures. One of them, here's a condition. Suppose I'm saying, see, if I have A, B, C are my rankings, or I have A, C, B, well, these two differ. One of them is, or if I have C, A, B, well, these aren't all the same. This one right here says I have A, B, and I have zero people in between. Here it says I prefer A to B, but I have one between. Here I have A, B, but I have zero between. You can't write down this information if people have cyclic preferences. Then it's always zero. And so the condition is that if... So here is a little extra information along with binary independence, which shows that the people have not cyclic preferences. And then the procedure is the board account. That's where you give 2 points to your first place alternative, one to your second, and zero to your third. And that's the only way of choosing weights so that that's the case. That's a symmetry argument again. All right? And so what do we have here? Repair of sen. If you have sen's theorem, if the minimal liberalism is what causes the difficulties, then we have to repair that. So let's go back to sen's theorem to see how to repair it. See what I use for preferences up here? I use D, A, B, C, B, C, D, A. If I use that ranking wheel argument I told you about before, 1, 2, 3, 4, A, sorry, Florin, A, B, C, D, you will see immediately that these are two elements, that these are two elements from the Z4 orbit of that ranking. See, if I have A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, rotate it, then I'm going the other way, I'll have D, A, B, C, D, and rotate it some more, and I'll get this one right here. All problems that crop up in sen's theorems, Arrow's theorem, etc., are caused by these symmetry situations. Or, in your work, circulant matrices, which are the same. So, what we want to do is take a look. This person prefers A. Person 1 is decisive over AB. All right. Not very strong preferences, but prefers A over B. But notice what everyone else does. Everyone else has the opposite preferences and really hates B. A, rather. Really hates A. Well, you get right back to the same argument. How strong and how weak are their likes and dislikes?
which come from transitive, which you can get from transitive preferences or not. And what you can do is the person's one's decision is incurring what the economists would say a strong negative externality on everyone else, imposing a solution on them which they strongly dislike. And so to get rid of sin, all you have to do, if I can find the right sheet, to get rid of sin, all you have to do is state that in place of minimal liberalism is that you can choose what shirt you want to wear as long as people don't have strong negative externalities about it, as long as they don't go, oh, God. And if you have something like that, then you would start getting good procedures. So what we have here, let me just repeat down here, and then I'll get a quick description of something that I had promised. What we have here is the following. Errol's theorem has been looked at by economists, political scientists, social scientists, mathematicians, where they've used filters and ultra filters, etc., algebraic topology, everything else to try to define various arguments. And one of the, and the real reason none of them have been able to catch it is they just assume that what's given, the assumptions, are active. They're unaware of the fact that what's happening, it's that one of the that other assumptions can go back and negate one of the earlier assumptions. And once you realize this negation effect is going on, you say, well, no big deal. That's pretty obvious. That's exactly where it crops up. The same thing happens in economics in a large number of other situations. For example, think of back in college days, when it was Saturday night and time for a beer party. What did you do? Pass around a hat and put in as much as you plan to drink. And then you got all the money and you go out and buy the keg. And then you drink.
As much as you can.
And then you already know what's going to happen, don't you? And so really what happens, though, it's that that procedure where you separate the two ends up with the free rider problem. Now, the economists have come up with terms about internalizing externalities and all sorts of other type things for having it. Nonsense. It's the same thing as Errol's theorem. The parts where you're allowed to drink beer allows for irrational people that want to pay much, drink none. All right, so the rest of you are the other type. Pay little and drink much. The intention was for people to pay as much as they drink. But when you have them separated up here, you're losing information. You're losing information of what kind of people you're dealing with. And that's the free rider problem. You go on and on and on through economics and social sciences, and you find a large number of these problems where the procedure separates into parts. Whenever you see the procedure separated into parts, expect problems. Expect problems. And it really is nothing more than a manifestation of Errol's theorem, which says that information is lost once you get a sufficiently heterogeneous society. This last slide, I'm just going to indicate problems that can crop up and where they come from, but I'm not going to go into it. I don't have time. Other election oddities. She slept in on election day. She didn't vote. Could she be rewarded by not voting? Could she get a better election outcome? The answer is yes, with some procedures. Suppose strategic voting. Is it possible to vote strategically? Of course, we all know that. We do that all the time. But suppose he's a candidate and he's winning. And if he's winning, he gave a tremendous election campaign. I heard you on TV last night. He gave a tremendous debate, won the debate. And so more voters want to vote for him. Could it happen that with additional support, he loses? It can. All kinds of peculiarities of this type are very possible. Tip of an iceberg. You can go on and on and on. Let me give you an example and then indicate briefly why this can happen. I'll have time to do that. Standard runoff. Got a standard runoff, and what happens is 12 people prefer A, B, C. You can read off right here. And I computed. The plurality outcome is A beats B beats C with a tally of 16 to 11 to 10. The pairwise outcomes, A will beat B or C will beat A. The tallies are given right here. Now, what happens is she, let's suppose a voter votes and gets more support. Suppose right here, B, C, A. A gives a good, right here if you take a look, what's going to happen? You run off, C is dropped, you have an election between A and B, and A wins. Now let's suppose we have that you give a very, very good talk, and two of these people right here really prefer A. So they're going to jump A from bottom to top. What's going to happen? A gets 18 votes, B gets 9 votes, C gets 10 votes. So the runoff is between A and C, and where C beats A. So by getting stronger support, C wins. This can happen with all runoff procedures, all parts. Suppose you forgot to vote. Well, suppose two of these voters right here, if they vote, A wins. Their last choice, A wins. Suppose two of these people just plain said, oh, the heck with it, I'm not going to vote. Down with the system. And if two of them don't vote, then what happens is we get 16, 9, 10, and the runoff is between A and C beats A. So by not voting, they get a better outcome. And strategic voting crops up similarly. How in the heck does this happen? Two ways, folks. One is I'm dealing with pairs. And really, it is, again, this cyclic behavior from the Z3 orbit that I've talked about. That if you don't have any of the cyclic effect where we're losing information, we think the outcome is reflecting everyone, but really the outcome is reflecting non-existent voters, cyclic voters, from the aggregation procedure, that is what causes all of these outcomes. A second thing is, what mathematicians like to do is they like to take F inverse of A. F inverse of A in this example looks like this. Those are all the profiles where F inverse of A will give rise to A as a winner with the runoff outcome. Whoops, it's not convex. It's not convex. So if my outcome's here and I add one voter here, I'm going to go into an outcome where B or C can win. So really what happens then is the underlying mathematical structure of the inverse image. But the key culprit is mathematical symmetry. As I stated a couple of times before, my training is in dynamical systems and analysis, and it's turning out that symmetry, symmetry groups, are really the answer for so many of these different issues which we have here. So with that comment, I think I'll close. I want to thank everyone. I had an absolutely delightful stay up here in beautiful British Columbia. God, it's a beautiful place. And so I thank you very much.
Well, but Don is still going to be around for a while, so we can take questions. Of course, if you would like to have any questions with coffee and donuts afterwards.
Yes.
Just a comment here. That's also known as a Coombs welfare function.
Yeah, but you can do... which one?
The board account.
In statistics, it's known as something like that. Do you know, Chandler?
The other name of the...
Board account, yeah.
I thought it was Coombs Social Welfare. But the point is, when I read that literature, everybody says, well, we're violating independence of irrelevant alternatives, as if that's a bad thing.
Well, it turns out that the independence of irrelevant alternatives, with the stories one gives, it sounds absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But then the reason it sounded like a horrible thing is we never understood what it was doing. We knew it was doing something wrong, but we didn't know what it was doing. And so then what I've shown, as I've shown here today, it's that what it does is it throws away something we take much more dear, and that is transitive preferences. It totally emasculates the assumption that people have transitive preferences. So no wonder we have a dictator. It's the only way we can take the parts and pull them back together again if we're just dealing with one person. So no, a dictator doesn't sound so surprising anymore. And the same thing...
Football players get it right then. I mean, the U.S. rankings are based on
board. Ah, yeah, they're based on board accounts, correct. Absolutely. And also basketball. Yeah. But some of these results about board account are very new. They're within 2 years old, showing how the underlying symmetry groups and everything else are in there. And what I'm doing is I'm just learning how to get rid of some of the technicalities and present it in more civilized terms on there. Yes?
Stephen Grahams and his friends argue for approval voting. There are different versions, and they don't claim that all paradoxes are eliminated. But they argue somehow that more paradoxes are eliminated that way than any other way.
Yeah, and they're wrong. They're totally wrong. What happens is you can just take absolutely simple examples, and it turns out that what happens is... Take 50 people prefer A, B, C, 48 prefer B, C, B, A, C, and maybe 30 people prefer C, A, B. Okay, there's data. And who do you think might win here? Who do you think should win? The fact is that in this situation, any of the 13 rankings can occur with approval voting. Any of the 13 rankings. The fact is that in this particular outcome, what you're doing is you end up with something like about 6,000 or 7,000 different possible scenarios and election outcomes that come up. And what Brahms and Fishburne do is they collect these things and then they select the ones which are most favorable to the situation, ignoring all the others. Beautiful case in point. In 1992, there was an election between President Bush, Sr., Clinton, and Perot. That if you use any of the ways to vote, pairwise voting, you would have that Clinton would have beaten Perot and Clinton would have beaten Bush. Any ways of giving weights, how much weight do you want to give to a first-place candidate, a second-place candidate, a third, Clinton would have beaten Bush, would have beaten Perot. If you had used approval voting, we could be talking about President Perot. And the reason is, and in fact, you can give a very convincing scenario explaining that. Who's going to vote for their second place candidate? A Clinton voter is not going to vote for Bush if Bush is second place. You might vote for Perot if Perot's in second place, because Perot didn't have much of a chance. A Bush voter voting will not have a vote for Clinton if Clinton's in second place, but they might if Bush were. I mean, for Perot. And Perot voters are only going to vote for Perot. They don't want to help anyone else, huh? So when you look down at the individual initiatives, and then you look at the vote which Perot had, you see it was very easy for Perot to would have won under approval voting. And when you look at it has only been used in one place where they have actually had the data to look at the data of how the people ranked the preferences and what was the election outcome. This happened about 2 years ago. Not one of the predictions of Brahms and Fishburne came out. They were all violated with actual data. So what they're doing is they're creating, they're imposing restrictions, very, very strong restrictions and strong scenarios, and saying, see what happens. Well, I can do that too. Give me any mapping and I can show you if I can, you know, from R3 into R2, I put the right restriction. They'll say, see what happens? And that's what happens because their domain is so much larger. So quite frankly, because of some of my recent results, what they're now saying is, and there are a couple of papers which I have seen, which are contending that, okay, the border count gives us the legitimate outcome, but the approval voting is a way to get the easy way to get the border count outcome. And that's false, too. That's absolutely false. You're assuming such strong, strict conditions on the voters' preferences that by that time you're saying, is this realistic? And so it's wrong. In my opinion, when I first heard of approval voting, I was chair of the math department at Northwestern. And I just heard of it, and they asked me, Don, they said, what kind of voting method do you want to have? You know, we're selecting a committee to select a new president. And I just heard of this approval voting, and it sounded pretty good, so I said, approval voting. The chair of the history department called me a little after they accepted it and says, Don, he says, did you see that stupid method they're using? and I said, well, yeah. what do you see wrong with it? He says, God, he says, can our two departments, can we manipulate that thing? What we need is six people on the committee. Your department selects three. Our department will select three. We're the two largest departments. We'll vote for those six and only those six. I won't tell you if we did that. But it's easier to manipulate than any other procedure, all sorts of things. Yeah?
I just wanted to ask if you think it's possible, or perhaps it's being done, to prove that the border count is the only way to guarantee that we simultaneously avoid all of the...
That's what's done, yes. Okay. But it's done under certain assumptions which are stricter than what we see in reality. That if everyone has transitive preferences, you know, the usual assumptions, then you can prove that it is the unique procedure to minimize the types of things that go wrong. Not only can you show that it is the unique procedure to minimize the type of things that go wrong, but you can show what causes any other errors. That Z symmetry that I was showing you, that cyclic symmetry, that Condorcet type thing is the only thing that causes problems. So once you understand that, you now know how to use the procedure. But, come on, you've been at elections and I have, and you look at the list and you say, who in the hell are all these people? We don't have rankings over everyone. Or when I was back at Northwestern one year, we had over 1,000 applicants for about four positions. Come on, I can't rank all 1,000 of those. I'd be lucky if I can rank five of them or six of them. But now that we understand the mathematics and the symmetry group argument, which gives it to you, we now can go after it and find procedures which will minimize errors and maximize conformance with what the voters really want. In fact, when I was at Northwestern University and I was starting some of this research, and they were saying, gee, that's not the n-body problem, Don. I said, no, it's voting. And they said, well, why don't you give us a lecture? And I said, no. Fine, you're going all around giving lectures on voting theory. Why don't you give a lecture? Nah. Come on. All right. I gave a lecture, and my worst fear was realized. The next day, we switched to the board account. You see, the voting procedure we had was not the board account, but what it was doing is was giving, as a result, it was giving highly distorted outcomes. But outcomes that I personally preferred. And sure enough, once we got the board account, we got fairer outcomes. My dismay. With that, I think I should quit.
Okay, let's thank you once again.